Hello, I'm Terrence Bowman. This is number 0596 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And here it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0596. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, actress Carolyn Hennessy is back on the show. The General Hospital star recently celebrated her 500th episode on the soap opera playing Diane Miller.
It was an incredible milestone, especially when you consider that Diane Miller was, 14 years ago, a two-day job. That was it. Fabulous love sparks just flew all around that stage, and people said, yes, we need more of Diane Miller. And Maurice Bernard, who I think was very instrumental in keeping Diane as his lawyer, I owe so much to him, and Jill Fehrenfeld, and Bob Guza, who was the head writer at the time, and Elizabeth Cordy. It was really kind of an alignment of planets. It's wonderful. It's a great, great, great success story for my personal life.
We remember actor Peter Mark Richmond, who recently died at the age of 93.
I had a real burning desire that started when I was quite young. I was in school plays, but then when I was in high school, I had an English teacher who said, you know, you have a very good voice. I'd like to take you down and give you an audition for the civic programs in Philadelphia. And I went and I did, and I got the job. I used to do like three voices, different voices on these programs, the civic programs about William Penn in Philadelphia and Benjamin Franklin. I would play several different characters in each show, and that really, really excited me.
Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com on the story of a reluctant French executioner.
Charles André, he was a fourth-generation executioner. This was the family business. He didn't like it. This was not something he wanted to do. In fact, he was studying in school. He was in medical, studying medicine, and then his father grew ill, was unable to continue his job, and so he had to take up the sword and the axe and continue on the family business. His paternal grandmother really pushed him to do it. This was their source of income. And, you know, when you were an executioner family, you didn't really have a lot of other big job opportunities. Like, oh, let's go hire the executioner's kid. You know, like, no, you followed in your father's footsteps.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0596, was Terrence Bowman, a Montreal-based actor with an amazing list of credits. In addition to all the things he's done on stage and on screen, he was also a member of the nationally renowned Montreal-based sketch comedy troupe, The Vestibules. And you can still find some of their albums. You can buy them. They're great stuff. They hold up very, very well. Check out his website at terrencebowman.com, and you can find the link to his website by going to my website and checking out this week's show, which you just heard him say the number for. See how this all comes around full circle? Thank you very much, Terrence, for doing the guest lead on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? As you know, there are varying degrees of COVID lockdowns in various jurisdictions around the world. Here in Quebec, where I am, at press time, we are in a curfew situation between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. There is very little you can do at that time of night outside, short of those who are working. Of course, one loophole is that you can walk your dog at night, but you're limited to being within a kilometer of your home to do so. Well, a couple in Sherbrooke, Quebec, tried to test that law. The couple have been fined for breaking COVID curfew rules after the woman was caught walking her husband on a leash. The woman reportedly told police that she was just out walking her dog. The pair were spotted by police at around 9 p.m. They reportedly told police that they were following the rules for pets. Isabelle Gendron from the Sherbrooke Police Department said the couple did not cooperate with police at all, and they were fined over $1,500. I don't know why they just didn't go all out and not stop with just a leash. Her husband should have had a muzzle and a veterinarian dog cone around his neck, too. You know, go big or go home. Actually, go big or stay home. We're in a curfew, you know. Police in the Japanese community of Funabashi City have arrested 26-year-old Rusei Takada for allegedly stealing more than a dozen toilets from houses under construction. The thefts began in October and continued, with local media dubbing the elusive thief the God of Toilets, until Takada flushed himself out by selling a brand new fixture to a secondhand store in the city. Takada, a construction company office worker, admitted to the thefts and said he did it to cover my living expenses. Well, the whole scheme was a bit of a crapshoot anyway, but now his life has gone down the drain.
Uh-oh! You're getting flushed! So sorry.
And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Tanya and Emma Booth were driving by a cemetery in Mount Dora, Florida, when they spotted an open casket. After checking on it, they called the police. There were four open graves, and a fifth showed signs of attempts to access it. The bodies were exposed and dismembered, Tanya recalled. Deputies found cigar butts at the crime scene. DNA analysis linked them to 43-year-old Brian Tolentino, who allegedly confessed to going to the cemetery with 39-year-old Juan Lopez, opening the graves and stealing several heads. Police searched Lopez's home, where they found six skulls, including two obtained from other sources, along with other body parts in what investigators believed to be a religious shrine. Well, you know, it had to be something religious with six heads, because they would only need five heads for a really creepy Newton's cradle. Anyway, both men were charged with four counts of disturbing a grave and abuse of a dead human body. That's right.
Abuse of corpse.
No family should have to go through this, Tanya said. Once you put your family to rest, that should be the end of it. Well, Tanya, unlike the grave robbers, has a good head on her shoulders. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Here's a woman I can talk to all day. Actress Carolyn Hennessy is back on the program. She has just reached a TV milestone. Back on December 22nd, ABC aired the 500th episode in which she played her recurring character of Diane Miller on General Hospital. Carolyn joins us on the line from California. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello, my friend. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for doing this, and congratulations on your milestone.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's it was an incredible milestone, especially when you consider that Diane Miller was, 14 years ago, a two-day job. That was it. And sort of, you know, fabulous love sparks just flew all around that stage, and people said, yes, we need more of Diane Miller. And Maurice Bernard, who I think was very instrumental in keeping Diane as his lawyer, I owe so much to him, and Jill Farren Phelps, and Bob Guza, who was the head writer at the time, and Elizabeth Cordy. So, you know, it was really kind of an alignment of planets. Ended, you know, 14 years ended up being that, and 500 episodes and counting. It's wonderful. It's a great, great, great success story for my personal life. So there you go.
Now, having done the show for so long, and I'm sure the idea of playing Diane, it fits like a glove, and you go through routines and how you portray the character and how other characters coexist with Diane and just the work schedule in general. But nowadays, we're living in a different world, a COVID world. How has going to work on General Hospital been different from before?
Well, first of all, I have the mindset that I'm simply not going to get sick. And that's the overriding. It's very much mind over illness at this point. Now, having said that, I happily abide by all of the protocols. And that means that I put on my Disney approved and issued mask when I get out of my car, walk across the parking lot, into the building, still have the mask on, and don't take the mask off ever unless I'm in my dressing room having my makeup done. Or the countdown starts and they're about to call action. And that's just sort of the way it is. And is it difficult to get used to? Yeah. Yeah. Is it bothersome? A little. Is it, you know, inconvenient? You bet. But all of that pales in comparison to continuing to work, to put out a great product, to get a paycheck. You know what I mean? So it's like we can put up with all of that, and everyone follows those protocols on that soundstage to the letter, to the letter. So we have a really good track record of people staying healthy, and that overrides any inconvenience that we may be presented with.
Has it changed the interaction with your fellow actors on the set, and has it changed how the show was written to accommodate, if need be, social distancing?
No, because we are all masked up. So there is no social distancing, as far as I can tell, you know, the scenes that I'm in the show. I'm just assuming that the writers naturally assume that everyone in Port Charles knows and has at this point slept with everyone in Port Charles. So everybody knows everybody. It's like we're one giant, big giant, you know, 80-person happy family. But the interaction on the set, it started out, you know, back in July when we were first confronted with the fact that we have to wear masks now all the time. Of course, there were jokes, and there was, you know, the occasional sigh and so on and so forth. But now it's become, fortunately and unfortunately, the new normal. So we just you know, plow through it. It's a matter of course. That's all it is. So basically the interaction is now kind of back to where it used to be, and where we look at each other as if we didn't have masks on, but of course we do. And I don't know if there are any COVID storylines actually on the show, because I only know mine, and there are, you know, a dozen others. So I don't know. You can tell me better if there are any COVID storylines. I don't know. Maybe in the hospital. I'm just unaware, because I, you know, I only get my scene. I don't get the entire script anymore.
What is the status right now? And I bring that up only because at the time we're recording this, I mean, you've been through a shutdown in California before, and then things calmed down a little bit, and then it escalated once again, the pandemic. So what is the current situation with your shooting schedule? Because I know some shows are shut down and some are not.
Right. We were supposed to go. I was supposed to be at work on the 7th, and they pushed it 2 weeks. And so now my first day of work is a week from today. And I could not be happier. So I went in for a COVID test yesterday morning. I'm going in for another one tomorrow morning, and I'm going in for another one on Tuesday. And then things, because we were so long on the Christmas holiday break, that every one of us has to test 3 times, and then we're going to go back to testing, you know, when we are slated to work again.
How did you pass?
It's interesting, really interesting.
How did you pass the time during the shutdown? For instance, I know from previous conversations with you that you exercise using a trapeze. Have you been doing that at all?
Oh my gosh, are you kidding? I now have several trapeze routines. We actually put on a show in November. We put on a Zoom show. Next time we do that, I will have you Zoom in. And you can see what I've been doing. I've been baking and trapezing and doing boatloads of reading, playing online escape room games with my best friend, because we can no longer go in person to escape rooms for the time being. I've been doing crossword puzzles, reading. I'm reading Huckleberry Finn, and after that, I will start War and Peace. So, you know, there you go.
Well, that's a lot of reading, but I know in the past, again, from previous conversations with you, that you've done quite a bit of writing. You've had your Pandora.
Writing, yes.
Yeah, you've had your Pandora book series for teens, or for tweens, rather. Have you done any more writing?
Pandora series, yes. I've finished, I'm working on 2 screenplays now, finished a screenplay. So, yes. So I've been doing a boatload of writing, too. Yeah.
There is no moss growing on Carolyn Hennessy, is there?
There is no north side to me, baby. I'm just spinning around like a top.
You kind of answered it when you mentioned the fact that Diane was just a 2-day gig when you first started. I know soap operas have had an opportunity to go for a long period of time. When you first started playing the role of Diane, were you hoping for the possibility that you could get to the point where you are at now 500 episodes and counting? Oh, or was that just...
Never crossed my mind. I thought it's going to be 2 days. I'm in and out. I will acquit myself well, and they will be glad they had me. There you go. But never did I think it was going to be, 500 plus episodes over 14 years. My goodness. No, never. And I am so grateful. And I will always be forever grateful. He is one of my heroes, one of my champions, Mark Teschner, the casting director, who called me up and said, you know what? I'm trying to get you a couple of days work on General Hospital. And because Mark and I had been friends, he knows my work inside and out, even before Diane Miller. And so I had to race home. And those were the days where I had to, like, get them my reel or send them my link. And my link to my reel, it was all sitcom. It was all comedy. And they looked at it and they said, okay, we will take a chance on this actress because we see something we like. It's not necessarily soap opera-y, but we will take a chance. And I'm so glad they did. I'm forever, forever, grateful.
What I do miss is your work as Barb on Cougar Town. That was fun.
You and me both. You and me both. Of course, I wish I'd been able to actually fish out all of those seasons of Cougar Town. I wish Barb had remained a bit of a staple, because there was nothing like walking into a scene, dropping a little comedy atom bomb, and then running away and looking back on all the destruction. It was hilarious. So, things will happen again, I'm sure.
In doing the role of Diane Miller for so many years, let me rephrase this. Have the writers come up with things that are more Carolyn-like? In other words, have you two melded the character of Diane and you?
Well, first of all, Diane started out as me because there was no template. There were no parameters. She was Sonny's lawyer. Well, what does that mean? That means that I, as an actor, get to bring everything to bear. I get to be very creative in what I am going to bring to the table. And they liked what I brought to the table, so it stuck. So there's a lot of Carolyn humor, Carolyn energy, Carolyn, I like to think, intelligence, Carolyn, thrilling new clothes. Diane has a bit of a shoe fetish, which Carolyn subsequently developed because I didn't have it when I started. I was wearing the same pair of cowboy boots, I think, for 3 years, but now, Lord help me, I do. And so there's so much of Diane that is Carolyn. There's a lot of Diane that isn't Carolyn, because Carolyn has no idea what about the law. Not any. I mean, every once in a while I will read something in the script and I'll say, look, even I know that that's not legal. You got to change. Or even I know that this isn't the best defense. Come on. So I'm able to do that. But they also let me every once in a while throw in some, even a few more Carolynisms. They even let me play with the humor a little bit more. So that's delicious fun. It's never a job for me, but that's when it becomes bliss. Shall we say?
Well, congratulations on 500 episodes. Here's to 500 more.
Well, thank you, my friend. You're such. I mean, I wish everybody on this planet had someone like you in their corner, the way I feel I do. You're just a lovely, lovely friend, and what a great career you've chosen, because I get to be the beneficiary of it. So,
well, thank you very much for being on the program once again. It's always a joy, Carolyn.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it so much.
Carolyn Hennessy, who plays Diane Miller on General Hospital. As mentioned, she's also the author of the tween novel series called Pandora. Actually, you can go into the Stuff File program archives and find three previous visits. She's on show number 0557 from April of 2020. She's also on 0306 from June 2015. and also way back on number 0041 from May 2010. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0596, and you'll find not only links to Carolyn's website, but also links to her previous appearances on the show, and links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book series for tweens called Pandora. It might be a cool thing for your tweens, especially girls, to read while they're cooped up during this time period. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll remember the late actor Peter Mark Richmond, who passed away just last week. Also, Mark Hartzman is back with another weird historian feature, this one, of course, for the month of January. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more in Stuff File News here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere for all your devices on Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. And you'll also find us on several fine radio stations over the air, such as WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, WLSL, LPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, and CKHR Hay River in the Northwest Territories, just to name a few. Thanks to all for joining in. Don't touch that dial. Well, here's an important tip if you still have your Christmas tree around. The city of McKinney, Texas, is reminding residents to properly dispose of their Christmas trees. Want to know why? Because they were called out to a fire after someone tried to get rid of their tree by putting it into the fireplace. McKinney Fire Department officials responded to the call for a structure fire and arrived to find that Christmas tree had been placed in the home fireplace. Only the top of the tree was in the fire, so the flames traveled down the tree and out of the fireplace. The fire was quickly extinguished after firefighters arrived, and the damage was limited to the area around the fireplace, and one person was treated for minor smoke inhalation at the scene. See, this is why we can't have nice things. And a friendly $100 wager over the 2020 presidential election has landed in a Florida small claims court. Before the election, Sean Hines, a Trump supporter from St. Petersburg, reached out to Jeffrey Costa, an acquaintance who is a Biden supporter from Atlanta. The deal was sealed on Facebook Messenger. If Trump won, Costa would pay $100. If Biden won, Hines would pay up. But once the votes were counted, Hines refused to acknowledge the Democrats' victory, even after the recounts, the Supreme Court rejection of court challenges, and the Electoral College's confirmation. Costa decided to sue. He's seeking the $100 plus $250 in court costs and $300 in interest on the unpaid bet. Wow, that's a high interest rate. Anyway, Costa first messaged Hines on November the 7th, the day after the election was called in Biden's favor, to ask for the money. "Bro, the elections are determined by the courts, not the networks," Hines responded. The two continued arguing back and forth. "It's not settled by law, Sean," Costa said. "Trump is mathematically eliminated." When Costa told Hines in December that he planned to sue for the money, Hines unfriended him on Facebook. Gee, I wonder where Hines got the idea that the election isn't over and that you don't ever have to pay your debts. Perhaps Costa should also sue to see Heinz's taxes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next segment here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 26-year-old Asim J. Hiltz of Albany, New York, and Sharif A. Frazier of Schenectady returned their rental car on January 13th, leaving behind an impressive amount of drugs and paraphernalia. Albany County Sheriff's deputies were called and arrived at the same time that Hiltz and Frazier returned to pick up their forgotten items, which included heroin, oxycodone pills pressed with fentanyl, marijuana, and almost $6,000 in cash. Both men were arrested and faced drug charges. Isn't it nice when the rental company is courteous enough to call when you leave something in their cars? That's just good business. It's dumb renters for showing back up, but it's good business. These guys weren't too thrifty, were they? That's gotta hurt. Anyway, let's get to our next segment here in this edition of the Stuff File program. Actor Peter Mark Richmond died on January 14th in California at the age of 93. Those of you who grew up like me, parked in front of the television during the 60s and 70s, would remember Peter. He was one of Hollywood's notorious on-screen bad guys, with literally hundreds of guest appearances on just about every popular show imaginable. We're turning the clock back two decades to May of 2001 for my first conversation with Peter Mark Richmond. Back then, we talked about one of his many books that he had written, plus a movie he was producing, writing, and starring in, plays he wanted to do, and all kinds of work that he was involved in that would tire most men 30 years his junior, never mind a guy who at that time was in his 70s. So, here is part of that 2001 conversation with actor Peter Mark Richmond. As I said in the introduction, you've conquered it all. I think a lot of people would recognize your face from various episodic television shows you've been. For those who might want to hone in on it, you also played the Reverend Snow, Chrissy Snow's father on Three's Company in a recurring character.
Yes.
And I remember you from Dynasty, from Longstreet, and like I said, a gazillion guest
spots. But you don't remember me. You're too young from Kane's 100.
No, I don't. I got to admit. What year was that on?
That was 61 and 62. That was my own series. I was Nick Kane.
Mm-hmm. As I said, you're sort of like a Renaissance guy. You've done everything, theater, film, television. You've written a book now. You also, by the way, do some amazing artwork.
Yes. Well, you know, on my book, the cover is one of my paintings.
Yes, I see that.
My second book just came out, and that's also my artwork.
I was going to ask where you find the time to write, but then I thought, well, I'm not going to ask that question because I know that a lot of times when you're an actor, you're paid not necessarily to act, but to wait.
That's right. And I'm rather compulsive. In other words, I have to be doing something. I've always been that way. I always feel like when I'm sitting around doing nothing, I'm really suffering. And I have to do something. And I've been really blessed to be able to, when I'm not working as an actor, to write and to paint. And to spend time with my children and fill my time, so, you know, hopefully constructively, and I think that's a gift.
Now, I said to you off air before we started that a lot of the things I'd seen you in were villainous roles in nature. You played a lot of bad guys, usually, you know, corrupt politicians, mean bosses in three-piece suits, that kind of thing. And the one thing I find that's interesting about all the people who do a lot of villainous roles is that they are really, really, really nice people.
Well, that's true. At least I found that to be so. But you know, there's a film that I produced last year, which is I haven't got it released yet. A picture called Four Faces, which I wrote and produced, and I star in, and I play four different people, really quite very diverse. And the first character I play, it's called Four Faces, and the first character I play is a pastor, fundamentalist pastor, giving a sermon in his church. The second one is an Italian-American father who loses a son to drugs. It's really very poignant. The third character, the third face, is an SS officer, ex-SS officer, living somewhere in South America whose grandson comes to visit him, which is a pretty frightening scene. And the last one is an 83-year-old Holocaust survivor who meets a young man in a park and reveals his philosophy of life, which is, he's sort of an up character. So you see, I do many different roles, and this is the first opportunity I've had to put them all together in one picture. which is based on a play that I had done a few years ago that I wrote.
And we should mention, if anybody wants more information right off the bat, you've also got an excellent website, which is petermarkrichmond.com. And people can find out more information about not only the films you're doing, but also the paintings you do and your book.
My book, my first novel called Hollander's Deal, which is really an inside look at the goings-on on Broadway and Hollywood. And it's really authentic stuff because I've been there. And even though it's fictional, it's really an inside look on what's going on and the characters as they evolve.
Any hopes of turning that into a film yourself?
Oh, that's going to be a film. But at the moment, there are no plans at the moment.
With such a variety of roles that you've played in different genres, do you have a preference? Is there a type of character you like to play? Do you like playing villains? Do you rather do comedy? Do you rather do straight drama? What would
I don't know. I get involved in whatever I is there at the moment. And I develop the characters as I go, and I find that the variation of things keeps me very interested. I love to do comedy, but mainly my comedy has been done on the stage. I've done a lot of comedy characters on stage. But the basis of my comedy is strong character, and which is to me is the funniest kind of character comedy, where the characters are very believable and the situations are very believable and not broadly done,
mm-hmm.
where you're overacting stuff and you get a laugh track. I don't mean that. I mean the stuff comes out of situation and the characters are so honest and believable and convincing and then the comedy comes out of the ridiculousness of what they're doing and saying.
As I said, you've accomplished so much doing so many different things. Is there an order in which came first? I mean, we primarily know you as an actor. Did you always want to be an actor? Did you want to be an author? Did you want to be a painter? Which came first?
Well, I was an art major as a kid. I was rather talented in sketching and painting when I was very young, and I went to art school when I was very young, when I was 9 years old and 10, 12 years old, and I was always annoyed that they wouldn't let me into the life classes. I was too young. And then they gave me plaster casts to do, which I didn't like very much. I always wanted to do there were always closed doors to paint the nudes. I wanted to really work on life things. So it took me a while to get to that. But I had a real burning desire, that started when I was quite young. I was in school plays. But then when I was in high school, I got into sports. I was really a football player, and I was captain of the city championship football team. That sort of gave me a sidetrack for a while. But I had an English teacher who said, you have a very good voice. I'd like to take you down and give you an audition for these programs, these civic programs in Philadelphia. And I went and I did, and I got the job. And I used to do like three voices, different voices on these programs, the civic programs about William Penn in Philadelphia and Benjamin Franklin. I would play several different characters in each show, and that really, really excited me. As a matter of fact, I was a member of AFTRA at 16 years old.
Mm.
I never joined AFTRA. It just evolved into AFTRA years later. Then when I came out of the Navy, I really wanted to pursue the acting bug, and I started doing little theater in Philadelphia, and eventually I moved to New York, and after I graduated pharmacy college, I'm a registered pharmacist.
Wow.
I have a license in Pennsylvania, New York. I never intended to go to New York to be a pharmacist, but I did take the New York State Board, and I have a license in New York and Pennsylvania, and I still maintain it just for kicks. I haven't practiced in all those years.
Now, why did you become a pharmacist? Was it something that maybe your parents wanted you to have something
to
fall back on?
Well, my father had died when I was very young, and I had a brother who was a pharmacist who said, you should have a profession, etc., and I was very resistant to it. A year went by after I came out of the Navy, and I had a lot of scouts come and watch me play football in an Eastern Pro Conference, which doesn't exist anymore in Pennsylvania. But I had a very serious injury, a leg injury, and that wrapped up my football days, and I matriculated to the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy after I had all these offers to go to Duke and Tennessee and Temple and Penn and all that stuff, and I finally succumbed to my brother's wishes, and I thought I would flunk out, But I stuck to it, and I graduated with pretty good marks in the upper area of the graduation class, and got my degree and got the state board. And I went away. I was managing a drugstore for a year in Rosemont, Pennsylvania, near Villanova College. And I was in little theater. I was in little theater, and I told the guy who was the set designer, I said, I was doing all the leads in these plays, and I said, get me a job in your professional equity company. And he says, well, I don't know whether I can or not. But I got a telegram from this producer who was 80 years old. His name was Royal C. Stout. I'll never forget. And he sent me a telegram and said, you are hired for second business for $35 a week. And I said, wow. And I quit my job. At that time, I was making $125 a week for 4 days working as a pharmacist. I quit that pharmacy job, and I went away to summer stock. I went to the first rehearsal, and there was a very attractive woman on the stage, young woman, the leading lady. And I thought she was pretty good. And we met. In 3 weeks, the leading man got fired. I became the leading man. And we did 14 shows together. And we fell in love. And a year later, we were married. And we've been married a long time. And we have 5 children, and I have 5 grandchildren.
Excellent.
She's a terrific woman who's behind me in everything I have done. And she's a blessing to me. I'm really very grateful.
I opened up by saying that you played a lot of villains, but since you mentioned the voice work, I'll balance it out by saying you did the voice of God once, didn't you?
Yes. That's a funny story. I was the voice of God on the Heroes of the Bible, and I remember I had a problem with NBC about the credits because they refused. They thought it was gauche to give credit to God, so they would only put me in the role at the end of the pictures.
Mm.
It really was very annoying. They had a real aversion to putting in the credits that the voice of God. They thought that would be sacrilegious or something.
You seem to have had a very charmed life. You pretty well managed to do everything you've set out to do, everything you've attempted, you've succeeded at. Is there anything you wanted to do that you didn't or couldn't?
I think that most actors, no matter how much they have done, and I must say I'm grateful to have done a lot of different things, and I've been fortunate to raise 5 children, and they've all been taken care of, and we live very well, and I really feel very blessed. Actors are a frustrated bunch, you know. They always feel they should have done this or want to do that, and they're still longing to do this and wanting to get this done and that. And you know, it's like if you don't have something to reach for, you become complacent, and I've really never felt complacent.
Is there a role that you've always coveted that you never got?
Well, I can't really say that because I'd have to start thinking back and doing. I've done so many different roles on the stage, especially that there are a lot of things that I would have liked to have done. I can't be at the moment very specific about what. I have a play that I've written that I want to do, a play called A Medal for Mary, which is a wonderful play about 2 old people in an old age home, and a son comes to visit, and it's very touching and very funny. I did it with Marion Ross out here in a staged reading. It was very successful about a year ago, but I got sidetracked with some of the other projects I have, but it's a very valid play, and it's a top comedy that if I can ever get around to pursuing what I need to do to get it on the boards.
You talked about playing sports and the fact that you were athletic. I remember from the days in Longstreet, the one thing I remember is that karate suit.
Suit?
Didn't you have a scene?
Oh, yeah.
In Longstreet?
Yeah, with
James Franciscus?
No, yeah, with him and what's his name?
Bruce Lee.
Bruce Lee?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a fight. He tries to instruct me, and I try to belt him one, and he shows me some stuff, and it's a very good scene. As a matter of fact, I think that's in the I okayed a documentary, or I thought I okayed a documentary, but I know that there are several Bruce Lee documentaries floating around, and a couple of them I'm prominent in, and I think they owe me some money. I can't track them down. One was made in Finland or someplace. But that scene is in that documentary.
With all the things that you've done, and again, I say you're very recognizable. Everyone, I'm sure, recognizes you from one role or another when they see you on the street. But does it ever surprise you the recognition you get for one thing or another? For instance, I know you've had an opportunity to play in Star Trek, The Next Generation, and Star Trek fans are very, very rabid. Does it ever surprise you some of the reaction you get for some of the parts you play?
Yeah, well, you know, it's very funny. I do some of these photograph signing things, autograph things. You go away to Star Trek conventions or celebrity convention things where you have a table and people come and ask for your autograph and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And people are really kind of amazing. They come up with books and things and photographs and things I haven't even seen, and they call me by the character's name, and I wonder who they're talking about, and they're talking about me. And photographs that they bring that they photographed off the screen, too.
Wow.
But one of the great kicks I had just a few days ago, my son, Lucas Richmond, is an assistant conductor of the Pittsburgh Symphony, and he is a fabulous composer. In fact, he did the music for my film, Poor Faces.
Yeah, and I noticed the name in the credits on your website.
Yes. You can go to his website, too, from my website as a link.
Okay.
He's an incredible composer, and Sunday night, I did the narration for a piece that he wrote called The Dachau Lied that was based on a short musical piece, a poem, that was written in Dachau. He took this piece and he created a whole ensemble with the chorus and orchestra, and it was played by the Jewish Symphony last Sunday on a Holocaust remembrance thing. It was very, very powerful thing, and I was very honored to be narrating my own son's piece.
That must be a great source of pride for you.
Oh, yeah, it was really quite thrilling.
I would assume with all the things you got going, the painting, the book, the acting, the writing, that you have no plans to retire.
No, no, God, no. What is retirement? Going into required inertia, one step in the grave, I don't like that idea at all.
The book is called Hollander's Deal. It's out there now. It's a novel by Peter Mark Richmond, and you can find it in stores. Also, I would assume, can you order it from the website?
Absolutely order it from the website.
Okay, and you
absolutely, and I got a second book that just came out called The Rebirth of Ira Masters, which is a collection of long and short stories.
Okay.
And three of them will make wonderful films.
And you also, speaking of films, have, as you mentioned, a new film coming out, Four Faces?
I have a new film, Four Faces, and also I just did the some dubbing for another film that I did with Rod Steiger and Christopher Walken called Pool Hall Junkies.
That was a conversation with actor Peter Mark Richmond from May of 2001. As you heard, he was always a busy man, even in his 70s. And he didn't slow down one iota for the next 20 years. As a matter of fact, just a couple of years ago, he was on the Stuff File program for number 0450, talking about his then-new book, I Saw a Molten White Light. You can go to my website and listen to that show as well. Peter was a fine actor who never gave up on the various aspects of the arts that he was passionate about. He died on January 14th at the age of 93. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0596, and you'll find links to Peter's site, plus links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his most recent books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we're going to get to some weird history in just a sec. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. No time for any more Stuff File news, except, of course, the idiot of the day. Let's just get to Mark, shall we? Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars and the curator of the website WeirdHistorian.com, is back for his monthly visit featuring a weird moment in history for the current month. So here we are in the month of January, and Mark joins us via Skype from New York. And I understand, Mark, that this time around, we have a real head turner.
Yeah, you could say that for sure. It turned heads right off the bodies.
Yes.
I was going to tell the story today of a French executioner named Charles-Henri Sanson, executioner in Paris.
Right.
In the 1700s, started in the mid-1700s, and went through the French Revolution. So he had a pretty rough stint of being the executioner. So Charles-Henri, he was a fourth-generation executioner. His dad, Jean-Baptiste Sanson, had inherited the job from his father, whose father had been the first Sanson to hold the title. So this was the family business. And Charles-Henri, he didn't like it. You know, this was not something he wanted to do. In fact, he was studying in school. He was in medical, studying medicine. And then his father grew ill, was unable to continue his job. And so he had to take up the sword and the axe and continue on the family business. His paternal grandmother really pushed him to do it. This was their source of income. And, you know, when you were an executioner family, you didn't really have a lot of other big job opportunities. Like, oh, let's go hire the executioner's kid. You know, like, no, you followed in your father's footsteps. So he had to start at a pretty early age, and it started in January of 1755. He was 16 years old.
Wow.
When he had to do his first execution. I mean, can you imagine? You know, like I said, he didn't like it. He wasn't excited about this at all. And that first execution, he just let his aides kind of do the dirty work while he was sort of turning his head and trying to not watch the action.
So even as an executioner, you have aides. Who wants that job? I mean, like...
That's a good question. I mean, the whole thing, I just imagine the family at home, like, talking about their day at work, you know? Like, oh, today was a rough one, you know? Having to talk about what they did and the people they had to execute. So at that time, you know, like I said, they used swords and axes. Swords were used for people of the nobility, and axes were for the commoners. And then if you were really a low life, you were broken on the wheel. There was, you know, breaking the wheel or, you know, hanging. So depending on where you were, you had different punishments.
Hmm.
So another January lowlight, I guess you might say, for Charles-Henri was in 1757, on January 5th, Robert-François Damiens attempted to assassinate Louis XV with a knife. It didn't work. The king was wearing, you know how those kings dress, they had lots of layers of clothing and a whole to-do. So I think that prevented the knife from really doing any serious damage. But Damiens was sentenced to death by the Parliament of Paris. And this wasn't like another, okay, we're going to, you know, Charles-Henri, pick up your sword and do the job. This was much more torturous. The sentence was something unlike any other Sanson had to deal with. So I'll just sort of, I'll give you a rundown of what they ordered him to do. So it started with putting Damiens on a scaffold, and his chest, arms, thighs, and calves were going to be burnt with pincers. And his right hand, the one that held the knife in which he tried to assassinate the king, was going to be burnt in sulfur. And then using boiling oil, melted lead and rosin and wax mixed with sulfur would be poured into his wounds. Okay, so after that, his body would be dismembered by four horses. So it was going to be quartered, you know, where the horses each are tied to a limb and they run in separate directions and, you know, yank your limbs off. And then those dismembered limbs and the body was going to be burned in fire. And then the ashes would be scattered to the winds. But we're not done yet. So after that, the court ordered that his property would then be confiscated to the king. And then the house that he was born in would be demolished. And after that, no other building could be erected on that spot.
So what you're saying basically is Louis XV could hold a grudge.
Yeah. He was not happy about the whole thing.
Wow. So
he really let him have it.
He sounds like the first Bond villain.
It's really crazy. So keep in mind, Charles Henry, our hero of this story, is now 18 years old and having to deal with this. And, you know, his dad's not able to help at this point. And he's like, what am I supposed to do? This is ridiculous. No one's had this experience. No one had been quartered in France since 1610. So he needed a little help. And so, you know, Grandma Sanson was like, you got to do it. So she got her other son, Charles Henri's uncle, Gabriel, who was also an executioner on another section of France. And he came to help. And so then they went out to do the job, and their assistants, you know, they ended up getting drunk and forgot to get the wax and the oil and all that good stuff to burn the wounds and, you know, cause initial torture. So they had to deal with that on their own.
I'm just wondering, did Charles Henri get this as a written statement, or was it verbally told him? Because all I'm thinking is, you know, you start off with what was the first thing?
The scaffold.
The scaffolding, and they go, okay, I can do that. And then somebody would say to him, but wait, there's more. And with each thing, but wait, there's more. It's like, wow.
Yeah. We're not exactly. It keeps going.
Yeah.
No, I imagine it was written, but I can imagine the same thing reading, like, okay, I got that. Oh God, we gotta do quartering? We're not done after the quartering? My God.
I mean, how dead is dead?
Yeah, no, this was like dead and then erased, right? So then the quartering, it didn't work well. So the horses couldn't carry out their end of the bargain. They couldn't separate the limbs from the body. They tried it three times.
Oh,
so rather than torture the horses, Gabriel and Charles Henri just had to do it themselves. So they grabbed an axe and they had to finish the jobs on their own. So you can just imagine, like.
And then after that, they went for dinner.
Yeah, right. Then they went home and, you know, had dinner and talked about it, right? So this was, you know, the first big botching of his execution career. He had another sort of botched job after that as well. There was one case where an old friend of his father's had been sentenced to death on some frivolous charge, as so many of them often were. And so Charles Henri had to make this a clean execution. There was a promise long ago from his father that if this guy was ever sent to be executed, he'd make it clean and quick and painless as possible. So Charles Henri had to live up to that promise from his father. And he couldn't. He put dropped the axe down, or the sword down, and didn't get the job cleanly done. So his father had attended and managed to pick up the sword and finish it himself as cleanly as possible. So that was another bit of a mishap.
Jeez.
So then January continues to be a rough month for Charles Henri. Fast forward a little bit to the French Revolution, you know, which began late 1700s. And at this point, we have the introduction of the guillotine. And the guillotine was designed to be a uniform way to perform capital punishment. So instead of having all these different forms like the quartering and the burning and all that good stuff, we would just have one method. We drop the blade and you'd be beheaded, and that would be that. And Charles Henri got to be part of that design. Even Louis the 16th was part of it. He actually suggested the angled blade. So then Louis the 16th, who chimed in on the whole thing, he got to test it out himself on January 21st, 1793, when he was sentenced to be executed. So Charles Henri had to execute the king in January. So after that...
And these guys don't work for tips, do they?
No. If they did, he probably would have done... He would have made a killing, so to speak. This was the reign of terror now. So again, keep in mind, his family, you know, the executions were always horrible, but they weren't constant, you know? But with the reign of terror... It was just constant. Between 1789 and 1796, he executed 2,548 people. And over his 40-year reign, he executed nearly 3,000. So you can see a pretty large percentage of that happened within 7 years. I mean, that must have just been horrific for everyone involved.
Wow. What happened in the future? You said this was a family business. Did Chuck have any children himself? And did they follow through in his footsteps?
Yes, he sure did. And they did. He had a son, Henri,
right,
who followed in his footsteps. And then Henri had a son, Henri Clément, mm-hmm, who carried on the family business as well. And he was the last generation of these Sanson executioners. So this all ended for them in 1847, after Henri Clément found himself in debt and he pawned the guillotine. So this was, he was in a tough spot.
Pawned it to who?
Can you imagine? Like, oh, I think I'll buy the guillotine at the pawn shop. So the government then needed the beheading done shortly after that, and Sansone didn't have it. So the government bought it back to the pawn shop. Again, I would love to see that transaction. That must have been kind of fun.
Yeah.
And they fired Henri Clément. But fortunately for him, the punishment, I'm sure much to his relief, did not include his former tool of his trade. So he was not beheaded by the guillotine.
Excellent.
But he lost his job and freed the other future Sansones.
Well, good for him. And again, going into that pawn shop, I'm guessing when you're dealing with the government to buy a guillotine, that's not a time for you to haggle.
Right. No. Probably not a good idea.
Not a good idea. That's a fascinating story. Oh, wow. Charles-Henri Sanson. What a sad life. I mean, a job he didn't want, and that's what it is when you're stuck in your dad's business, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Didn't want the job and then got stuck with the worst stint of it possible in history.
Yeah.
Just horrible.
Mark, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks. I can't wait to see what you come up with for February.
I'll be fun. Yeah, yeah. Thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars. His website is weirdhistorian.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0596, and you'll find the link to Mark's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
It's fair to say that on January 6th, there were a lot of idiots lingering around and in the U.S. Capitol building. But I want to highlight just one who stood out. And no, I'm not talking about that QAnon shaman wearing the horns. I'm talking about a 6'6" muscular man wearing a USA Olympic team jacket. I'm talking about Cleet Keller, a gold medal-winning Olympic swimmer. Keller was identified after conservative media site Town Hall posted a video that showed a tall man in a USA Olympic team jacket inside the Capitol at the time of the riot. Well, the 38-year-old Keller, who competed in three Olympics beginning in 2000 and earned five medals overall, including golds in 2004 and 2008, has now been charged for his participation in the breach of the U.S. Capitol. And needless to say, USA Swimming distanced itself from Keller, noting that he hasn't been a member of the organization since 2008, when he last competed in the Summer Games. So, it's safe to say that he'll never be on a Wheaties box ever again. I mean, why? Oh, why? If you are a recognizable 6'6" Olympic gold medalist, would you storm the Capitol building wearing a highly visible USA Olympic team jacket, thereby literally and figuratively sinking your reputation and Olympic glory? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0596. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0596. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.